I moved to the side of his bed. He turned to look at me, and a smile brought color to his face.
Just the person I was thinking of.
And here I am. Are you feeling up to this? Lucinda says you had a session with a respiratory therapist. She doesn't want me wearing you out.
No, no. I've rested a bit and I'm fine. I'm sorry to have to waste so much time in bed, but some days I'm not capable of anything else. I trust you received my check.
I did. The bonus wasn't necessary, but I appreciate the thought.
You deserve every penny. Reba enjoys her time with you, and I'm grateful for that.
Lucinda tells me she's been gone since dinner time last night. Do you happen to know where? He shook his head.
She sat with me through supper and helped me into the library afterwards. I heard her making a call. A cab arrived 30 minutes later. She said not to worry, gave me a kiss, and that was the last time we spoke.
She has a meeting at 1 o'clock today, and then a second meeting at 4. I can't imagine her a no-show. She knows how critical this is.
She made no mention of it. I take it she hasn't been in touch with you.
We talked briefly yesterday. She said she'd get back to me, but then she never called.
She did have a visitor. Fellow she used to work with.
Marty Blumberg?
That's him. He came up to the house, and the two had their heads together for quite some time. She went out afterwards.
Lucinda mentioned she was out late the night before.
She didn't arrive home until 2:30 in the morning. I was still awake when she finally pulled in the drive. I saw the headlights flash across the ceiling, and I knew she was safe. Old habits die hard. The months she was in prison, those were the only nights I didn't lie awake waiting for her. I imagine I'll die with an eye on the clock, frightened something's happened.
Why'd she call a cab? Is something wrong with her car? He hesitated.
My guess is she was leaving town and didn't want her car sitting in a parking lot somewhere.
But where would she go? Helplessly, Nord shook his head. Did she take any luggage?
I asked Freddy myself, and she says she did. Mercifully, Lucinda'd left by then, or I'd never hear the end of it. She knows something's happened, but so far I've kept her in the dark. Lucinda's relentless, so do be careful or she'll wheedle it out of you.
I gathered as much. Which cab company?
Freddy might remember if you want to talk to her.
I'll do that. A soft tap at the door and Lucinda appeared, holding up two fingers. 2 more minutes, she said, with a smile to indicate her good intent. Nord said,
Fine.
But I saw a flash of irritation cross his face. As soon as she closed the door, he said,
Lock that, and lock the door to the connecting bath while you're about it.
I gave him a momentary look, and then crossed to the door and turned the thumb lock. A large white-tiled bathroom opened off to the right, apparently joining his bedroom with the one next to it. I locked the far bathroom door, leaving the near one ajar, and then returned to my seat. He pulled himself up against the pillows.
Thank you. I suppose she means well, but there are times when she takes too much on herself. To date, I haven't appointed her my guardian. As for Reba, what do you propose?
I'm not really sure. I need to find her as soon as possible.
Is she in trouble?
I'd say so. Shall I fill you in?
It's best I don't know. Whatever it is, I trust you to take care of it and bill me afterwards.
I'll do what I can. A couple of government agencies are interested in talking to her about Beck's financial dealings. This is going to get sticky, and my position's precarious as it is. When it comes to the feds, I don't want to end up on the wrong side of the fence. If I'm working for you, no privilege attaches to our relationship in any event, so hiring me won't serve as protection for either one of us.
I understand completely. I wouldn't ask you to compromise yourself in the eyes of the law. That said, I'd be grateful for any help you can give her.
Is her car still here? He nodded.
It's parked in the garage, which is unlocked as far as I know. You're welcome to take a look.
There was a tapping at the door, and the handle turned. Lucinda rattled the knob impatiently, her voice muffled. Nord, what's wrong? Are you in there? He gestured toward the door. I crossed and unlocked it. Lucinda turned the knob abruptly and pushed her way in, almost banging me in the face. She stared at me, apparently assuming I'd lock the door on my own. What's this about? Nord strained to raise his voice.
I told her to lock it. I didn't want any further interruptions.
Her body language shifted from suspicion to injury. You might have mentioned it. If you and Miss Milhone have private business to discuss, I wouldn't dream of interfering.
Thank you, Lucinda. We appreciate that.
Perhaps I've overstepped my bounds. Her tone was frosty, the content designed to generate apologies or reassurances. Nord offered neither. He lifted a hand, almost a gesture of dismissal.
She'd like to see Reba's room.
What for? Nord turned to me.
Down the hall, to your right.
Lucinda cut in. I'll be happy to show her. We don't want her wandering around on her own. I glanced at Nord. I'll get back to you, I said. I followed Lucinda down the hall, noting her stiff posture and her refusal to look at me. When we reached Reba's room, she opened the door and then stood in my path, forcing me to squeeze by her. Her eyes trailed after me. I hope you're satisfied. You think you're so helpful. But you're killing him, she said. I locked eyes with her, but she was far more practiced than I at delivering the withering glance. I waited. Her smile was set, and I knew she was the sort who'd find ways to get even. Lucinda the bitch, indeed. She stepped into the hall. I shut the door and locked it, knowing she'd get the point. I turned and leaned against the door, making a visual survey, taking in the whole of the room before starting my search. The bed was made, a few personal mementos neatly arranged on the bedside table, a framed photo of her father, a book, a scratch pad, and a pen. No clutter, no clothing on the floor, nothing under the bed. A phone, but no personal address book. I went through the desk drawers, uncovering items that must have been there for years. School papers, exam books, unopened boxes of stationery, which were probably gifts, certainly not her taste, unless she favored kitty cat cards with cute sayings on the front. No personal correspondence, dresser drawers were neat. I checked the closet, where several empty hangers suggested the number of garments missing. 6, by my count. Among the articles she'd left behind were a navy blue blazer, a leather bomber jacket askew on its hanger. I had no way of knowing what she'd packed. I wasn't even sure the size or the number of suitcases she owned. I sorted through idly, thinking back to the clothes I'd seen her in. I didn't spot her boots or either of the sweaters I remembered, the one red cotton, the other dark blue with a cowl neck. She'd worn both within the first few days of being home, which meant they might well be her favorites, garments she'd want with her on the road. I went into the bathroom, which was close to barren, tawny marble floor tile and countertop, spotless mirrors and the smell of soap. The medicine cabinet had been emptied of items, no deodorant, cologne, or toothpaste, no prescription drugs. I could see a whitish spot on the marble counter where her toothbrush had lain. The hamper had been stuffed with blue jeans, T-shirts, and underwear. A bath towel, still faintly damp, crowded in on top. The shower pan was dry. Nothing in the trash. I went back to the closet and studied the clothes. I took the bomber jacket off its hanger and checked the pockets. I found some loose change and a slip from a generic order pad, that showed she'd paid for a cheeseburger, chili fries, and a Coke. No date, and the restaurant wasn't mentioned by name. I slipped the receipt into my jeans pocket and returned the jacket to its hanger. I let myself out of the room and retraced my steps. As I passed Nord's room, I paused and leaned my head close to the door. I could hear the murmur of voices, primarily Lucinda's, and she sounded aggrieved. Any further conversation with him would have to wait. I went downstairs and found my way to the back part of the house. The housekeeper was sitting at the kitchen table. She'd spread newspaper across the surface, on which she'd laid 12 place settings of sterling silver, 2 silver water pitchers, and a series of silver beakers. Some of the more ornate pieces had been sprayed with an aerosol polish that was drying to a strange shade of pink. The cloth she used on the flatware was black from the tarnish she'd removed. Her gray hair was wispy, curled, and back-combed into a dandelion aureole with patches of scalp showing through. I said, "Hi, Freddy. I've been chatting with Mr. Lafferty. He says you saw Reba last night before she left."
"Going out the door," she said,
addressing her remark to the spoon.
"She took a suitcase?" "Two. A black canvas overnight case and a hard-sided gray suitcase on wheels. She was wearing jeans and boots and a leather hat, but no jacket."
"Did you have a conversation?"
"She put a finger to her lips like this was our little secret. I was having none of that. I've worked for Mr. Lafferty 46 years. We don't keep secrets from one another. I went straight into the library and spoke to him, but before I managed to get him up from his chair, she was gone."
"Did she say anything about her intentions, any talk of a trip?" Freddy shook her head.
"There were calls back and forth, but she was quick to catch the phone, so I never heard who it was. I couldn't even tell if the caller was a man or woman."
"You know, it's a parole violation if she leaves the state," I said. "She could be sent back to prison."
"Miss Milhone, as fond as I am of her, I wouldn't withhold information or cover for her in any way. She's breaking her father's heart, and the shame's on her."
"Well, if it makes any difference, I know she adores him, which doesn't change anything, of course." I took out a card with my home number scribbled on the back. "If you should hear from her, would you call me?" She took my card and slipped it into her apron pocket.
"I hope you find her. He doesn't have much time."
"I know," I said. "He told me her car's still parked in the garage."
"Use the back door. It's closer than going out the front. There's a set of keys on the hook," she said,
indicating the service porch and the mudroom visible through the open doorway behind her.
"Thanks."
I snagged the keys and then took a diagonal path across a large brick apron, approaching what must have been the original carriage house, converted now to a 4-car garage. Rags appeared from around the corner of the house. Clearly, his job was to oversee arrivals, departures, and all activities involving the property. Above the garage, I could see a stretch of dormer windows with curtains drawn across the glass, which suggested servants' quarters or an apartment, possibly Freddy's. One garage was empty, the retractable door standing open. I used it as ingress and quickly spotted Reba's BMW parked against the far wall. I felt obliged to explain myself to Rags as he followed in my tracks. I got in on the driver's side and slid under the wheel. I put the key in the ignition and checked the gas gauge. The arrow jumped to the top, indicating a full tank of gas. I leaned over and popped the door to the glove compartment and then spent a few minutes sorting through the accumulation of gasoline receipts, outdated registration slips, and an owner's manual. In the side pocket to my left, I found another handful of gasoline receipts. Most were dated 3 to 4 months before Reba went to prison. The single exception was a receipt dated July 27, 1987. Monday. She'd bought gas at a Chevron station on Main Street in Perdido, 20 miles to the south. I added the receipt to the other one in my pocket. I checked under the front seats, the back seat, the floorboards, and the trunk, but found nothing else of interest. I left the garage and returned the keys to the hook in the mudroom, then collected my car. Last I saw of Rags, he was sitting on the porch, calmly grooming himself. I returned to the 101 and made a speedy round trip to my apartment, stopping off long enough to pick up the photograph of Reba her father had given me. I folded it and eased it into my shoulder bag before I headed for Perdido. The four-lane highway follows the coastal contours with the foothills on one side and the Pacific Ocean on the other. The concrete seawall all but disappears in places, and waves crack up along the rocks in an impressive display of power. Surfers park their cars on the berm and tote their surfboards down to the beach, looking as sleek as seals in their form-fitting black wetsuits. I counted eight of them in the water, straddling their boards, faces turned toward the waves as they waited for the surf to mount the next assault on the shore. To my left, the steeply rising foothills were bare of trees and thick with chaparral. Paddle-shaped cactus had taken over large patches of eroding soil. The lush green, encouraged by the winter rains, had given way to spring wildflowers, and then died back to this tinderbox of vegetation ripe for the autumn fires. The railroad tracks ran sometimes on the mountain side of the road and sometimes crossed under the highway and tracked the surf. On the outskirts of Perdido, I took the first off-ramp and proceeded toward town on Main, checking addresses along the way. I spotted the Chevron station on a narrow spit of land that bordered the Perdido Avenue off-ramp. I pulled in and parked on the side of the station nearest the restrooms. A uniformed attendant was standing at the rear of a station wagon topping off the tank. He spotted me, eyes lingering briefly before returning to his task. I waited until the customer had signed the credit card slip and the wagon had pulled away before I crossed to the pumps. I pulled out the photograph of Reba, intending to inquire if he'd worked on Monday, and if so, if he remembered her. As I approached, however, something else occurred to me. I said, "Hi, I need directions. I'm looking for a poker parlor called the Double Down." He turned and pointed. "Two blocks down on the right. If you get to the stoplight, you've gone too far." It was close to 2 p.m. when I pulled into the one remaining space in the parking lot, behind a low cinder-block building painted an unprepossessing beige. The sign in front flashed a red neon spade, a heart, a diamond, and a club in succession. The Double Down was written out in blue neon script across the face of the building. In lieu of stairs, a wheelchair ramp angled up to a windowless entrance, approximately 4 feet above ground. I climbed the ramp to the heavy wooden door with its rustic wrought-iron hinges. A sign indicated that the hours ran from 10 a.m. until 2 a.m. I pushed my way in. There were four large tables covered in green felt, each with 8 to 10 poker players seated in wooden captain's chairs. Many turned and looked at me, though no one questioned my presence. Along the rear wall there was a galley-style kitchen with a menu posted above the service window. The selections were listed in removable black letters mounted in white slots. Breakfast dishes, sandwiches, and a few dinner items. I was already partial to the scrambled egg and sausage breakfast burrito. I checked the receipt I'd found in Reba's jacket pocket. Cheeseburger, chili fries, and Coke. The same items were listed on the board, and all the prices matched. The walls were paneled in pine. Along the acoustical tile ceiling, a picture rail was festooned with strands of fake ivy and hung with framed reproductions of sports art, football dominant. The lighting was flat. All the players were men except for a woman at the back who was probably in her 60s. A chalkboard mounted on the side wall bore a list of names, presumably guys waiting for an open seat. To my surprise, there was no cigarette smoke and no alcohol in sight. Two color television sets mounted in opposing corners flickered silently with two different baseball games. There was scarcely any conversation, only the sound of plastic chips clicking together softly as the dealer paid off the winners and pulled in the losing bets. As I looked on, the dealers changed tables and three guys took advantage of the break to order something to eat. There was a counter to my left and behind it, in a cubbyhole, a fellow was sitting on a stool. "I'm looking for the manager," I said. I was wondering, of course, if poker parlors had managers, but it seemed like a safe bet, so to speak. The guy said, Yo! Raising his hand without lifting his gaze from his book. What's the book? He held it up, turning the cover into view as though wondering himself. This? Poetry. Kenneth Rexroth. You know his work? I don't. The guy's awesome. I'd lend you this, but it's the only copy I have. He put his finger between the pages, marking his place. You want chips? Sorry, but I'm not here to play. I took Reba's picture from my bag, unfolded it, and held it out to him. Look familiar? Reba Laverty, he said, as though the answer was self-evident. You remember when you saw her last? Sure, Monday, night before last. She sat at that table, came in about 5 and stayed until we closed the place at 2. Played Hold'em most of the night and then switched to Omaha, for which he has no feel, whatever. Had a roll of bills about like this, he said, making a circle of his thumb and middle finger. Chick's been out of prison a week, or that's the scuttlebutt. You her parole officer? I shook my head. A personal friend. I was the one who went down to Corona and drove her home. Should have saved yourself the trip. Before you know it, she'll be on the sheriff's bus heading the other way. Too bad. She's cute. About the way a raccoon's cute before it bites the shit out of you. I said, yeah, well, there you have it. She took off last night and we're trying to track her down. I don't suppose you know where she went. Off the top of my head, I'd say Vegas. She dropped a bundle in here, but you could tell she was on a roll. She had that look in her eye. Bad luck or good, she's the kind who keeps going till all the money's gone. I don't get it. You don't gamble? Not at all. My theory? Chick runs on empty. She gambles for the hype, thinking she can use that to fill herself up. Ain't never gonna happen. She needs help. Don't we all, I said. By the way, why the double down? I thought the term was blackjack. We used to have blackjack until the owner phased it out. The locals prefer poker. Skill over luck, I guess. As soon as I reached my office, I grabbed a pencil and notepad, hauled out the phone book, and chose a travel agent at random. I dialed, and when she answered, I told her I needed information about a trip to Las Vegas. What day? Don't know yet. I work until 5, and I'm not sure what day I want to go. What flights do you show for weekdays after 6 p.m.? I can check, she said. I heard tappity-tap-tap in the background, and after a silence, I see 2, U.S. Air at 7:55 p.m. by way of San Francisco, arriving Las Vegas at 11:16, or United Airlines 8:30 through Los Angeles, arriving LV at 11:17 p.m. Where else would I find poker parlors? Say again? Card parlors, poker. I thought you wanted to go to Las Vegas. I'm looking at all the options. Anything closer to home? Gardena or Garden Grove. You'd have to fly to LAX and find ground transport. That sounds doable. What flights do you have to Los Angeles after 6 p.m.? I know about the United flight at 8:30. Is there anything else? I show United at 6:57, arriving in Los Angeles at 7:45. I was taking notes as she spoke. Oh, wow, thanks. This is great. Somewhat testily, the travel agent said, you want to book one of these or not? I'm not sure. Let's try this. Say I had a few bucks in my hot little hand. Where else could I go? After 6 p.m. on weekdays, she said dryly. Exactly. You could try Laughlin, Nevada, though there aren't any flights into Laughlin Bullhead, unless you want to fly charter. Don't think so, I said. There's always Reno, Lake Tahoe. The same airport services both. Could you? I'm doing it, she sang. And again, I could hear her tapping her computer keys. United Airlines, departing Santa Teresa at 7:55, arrives San Fran, 9:07 p.m. Departs 10:20, arriving in Reno at 11:16. That's all there is. I'll call you back, I said, and hung up. I circled the word Reno, thinking about Reba's former cellmate, Misty Rain, allegedly living up there. If Reba were on the run, it might make sense to try connecting with a friend. Of course, consorting with a known felon was a parole violation, but she was already racking them up, so what was one more to her? I dialed directory assistance in Reno, the 702 area code, and asked the operator for a listing under the last name, Rain. There was one. First initial M, but with no address listed. I thanked her and hung up. I drew a second circle around the word Rain, wondering if Reba had been in touch with Misty since her release. I picked up the phone again and dialed the number I had been given for M. Rain. After four rings, a mechanical male voice said, "No one is home. Please leave a number." So uninformative. I really hate that guy. At 4:30, I drove back to the Lafferty estate. As I pulled into the parking pad, I was happy to note Lucinda's car was gone. Rags was asleep in a wicker chair, but he roused himself to greet me, sitting at my feet politely while I rang the bell. When Freddy let me in, Rags took the opportunity to slip inside. He followed as Freddy led me to the library where Nord was entrenched on the sofa, propped up against a mass of bed pillows and covered with a throw. He said,
"I had Freddy bring me down. I couldn't stand another minute upstairs."
Rags jumped up on the sofa, walked the length of Nord's body, and sniffed at his breath. I said, "You look better. You have some color in your cheeks."
"It's temporary, but I'll take what I can get. I'm assuming you've learned something or you wouldn't be back so soon."
I told him about the gasoline receipt and my drive to Perdido, where I'd been directed to the card parlor. I related the report I'd had about her poker losses Monday night. I couldn't see any point in plaguing him with the suspicion that she'd stolen $25,000, so I left that part out. Reba mentioned a stripper named Misty Rain, a former cellmate of hers. Apparently, Misty moved to Reno after she got off parole. I'm thinking if Reba's caught up in gambling, it'd be smart to scout out a place where she could also lay low.
"In which case she might try hooking up with this friend,"
Nord said, idly stroking the cat. "Right. That way, instead of laying out money for a room, she could drop it all at the tables and hope for some return. According to directory assistance, there's an M. Rain in Reno with no published address."
"But wouldn't traveling to Reno be a violation of her parole?"
"So's the gambling," I said. "There's always the possibility she'll come back before she's missed, but I hate to see her take the chance. Has she been to Reno before?"
"Often," Nord said. "But how can you be sure she's there? Her friend isn't likely to admit it."
"Oh, that's my thought, too. Reba didn't mention Reno."
"She never said a word."
"What about the phone company? I've been wondering if you could ask about any long-distance calls in the past 7 days. A match on Misty's number would at least suggest the two had been in touch."
"I can try."
I rounded up the phone book and dialed the number for him, taking him as far as the billing department before I handed him the phone. He identified himself by name and phone number and explained what he wanted. In the most glib and convincing manner imaginable, he spun a tale of an out-of-town visitor who'd made some long-distance calls but neglected to ask for time and charges. After chatting with the woman, he jotted a number in the 702 area code to which three calls had been made. He thanked her for her help, hung up, and handed me the slip.
"I'm afraid this still doesn't give you an address."
"I have a police pal, and I'm hoping he can help." Chapter 25. By the time I left Nord's, it was close to 5 o'clock. There was no point in returning to the office, so I headed for home. I let myself into my place and tossed my bag on a chair. Chaney had left two cranky messages wanting to know where the hell Reba was, as she'd missed her 1 o'clock appointment with Vince and her 4 o'clock meeting with the FBI. I called Chaney's pager, punched in my number, and waited for the phone to ring, which it did 10 minutes later. "You called? I need a favor. Can you check a phone number in Reno and get me an address?" "Who for?" "A friend of a friend." "Is this about Reba?" "Who else?" He thought about it briefly. "She's already in more trouble than she knows. If she's up there, the best thing for all of us is to have Reno PD pick her up." "Well, that's one approach," I said. "On the other hand, you still need her cooperation. I'm thinking about driving up to Reno and talking her into coming back, assuming I can find her. Does Holloway know she's gone? I doubt it, but Reba doesn't see her until Monday, which means we have 5 days before she'll be missed. I'd hate to do anything behind Priscilla's back, so you can tell her if you like. Or what? You can run it by your IRS buddies and see what they have to say. Maybe her value to them takes precedence, and they can square it with her P.O. There's plenty of time to tell Priscilla once Reba's been debriefed. Give me the number in Reno, and I'll get back to you. Why don't you talk to Vince first, and then I'll give you the number. We can work it out from there. You don't trust me? Of course I trust you. He's the one I'm worried about. What about tonight? You want to meet me at Rosie's? I've got a couple of reports to write, but it shouldn't take me long. Sounds good. I'll be there in a bit. I left my front door ajar and crossed the patio to Henry's. His kitchen door was open, and I knocked on the frame. Henry, it's me. Come on in. I'll be right there, he said. He had a pot of homemade soup simmering on a back burner, and I took that as a good sign. Henry seldom cooks or bakes when he's feeling down. His glass of blackjack over ice was sitting on the kitchen table, the newspaper neatly folded and waiting in his rocking chair. A newly opened bottle of Chardonnay was sitting in a cooler on the counter. He appeared from the hallway with a stack of clean towels. You should have poured yourself some wine. I opened that for you, something I want to talk to you about. You have a few minutes? He put the towels in a kitchen drawer and took a wine glass out of the kitchen cabinet and filled it halfway. Thanks. I have all the time you need. I've been feeling out of touch. How are you? I'm fine, thanks. What about you? He resumed his seat in the rocking chair and took a sip of his drink. I'm good, I said. Now that we've cleared that pithy matter, you want to tell me what's on your mind? He smiled. Here's what I've been considering. I don't think there's any remedy for my relationship with Mattie. At the moment, she's calling the shots, and I don't feel I can impose if she's not interested. That's the way of the world. We didn't know each other long, and there are all kinds of reasons it couldn't work. Age, geography, the particulars aren't relevant. What I realize is I enjoyed having someone in my life. It put a spring in my step, even at the age of 87. So I've been thinking it wouldn't be such a terrible idea to make a phone call or two. There were several women on the cruise who seemed lively and nice. Mattie may be one of a kind, but that's beside the point. He paused. That's as far as I got, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on the matter. I think it sounds great. I remember after you got home, you had all kinds of women leaving messages on your machine. Embarrassed me. Why? I'm old-fashioned. I was taught men should be the pursuers, not the other way around. Times have changed. For the better? Perhaps. You meet someone you like, why not make an effort? There's nothing wrong with that. If it works, it works, and if it doesn't, oh well. That's what I've been thinking. There's a woman named Isabel who lives here in town. She's 80, which is a little closer to my age. She loves to dance, which I haven't done for ages. And another woman, Charlotte. She's 78 and still active in real estate. She lives in Olvidado. Close enough, he said. You think one at a time might be good? Nothing wrong with both. Get your feet wet. The more the merrier. Good. Then that's what I'll do. He clicked his glass against mine. Wish me luck. All the luck in the world. I leaned forward and gave him a quick kiss on the cheek. I sat in my favorite booth in Rosie's, the one in the rear where I can sip a glass of wine while I keep a close eye on the place. I've been a regular at the tavern for 7 years, and I still can't tell you the names of the day drinkers or the other steady customers like me. Rosie's the only common thread, and I suspect if the other patrons and I compared notes, we all have the same complaint. We'd grouse at how she bullies us, but we'd all feel smug, seeing her mistreatment as a sign of just how special we are to her. William was working behind the bar. I'd stopped off on the way in and picked up the wine he poured when he saw me enter. He was busy, otherwise I was certain he would have given me the latest in his medical reports. Once settled, I took a sip of white wine so close to vinegar it was almost enough to make me swear off the stuff. Cheney had called back within minutes to tell me Vince was favoring the personal approach. He offered his blessings, as long as he was given the contact number as well. I gave Cheney the number I'd picked up from Nord's telephone bill. I assumed Vince Turner would keep the information to himself, but I worried the FBI would get wind of what was going on and make trouble. I put in another call to Nord to tell him I'd be taking off in the morning. He offered to underwrite the trip, and I'd accepted, any charitable impulse quickly overridden by the need to pay my bills. I'd brought along a pocket atlas, and I was flipping back and forth between Southern California and the western border of Nevada, considering my route. The obvious choice was to take Highway 101 to the 126, travel east as far as Highway 5, and then north to Sacramento, where I'd connect to the 80 on a north-to-east trajectory that would take me straight into Reno. If Cheney couldn't manage to get me Misty's address, I'd revert to the old-fashioned method. Check the public library for the crisscross directory, where phone numbers are listed in numerical order and matched with the corresponding address. Before I hit the road, I'd make a stop at the auto club and get a proper series of strip maps. I really didn't need them, but I like the white spiral binding and that arrow penned in orange that marches up the page. Makes me feel like I'm getting my money's worth for the cost of my annual membership. I moved on, making a mental list of clothing and toiletries I'd need to pack. I felt a hand on my shoulder and looked up with a smile, anticipating Cheney. Beck slid into the booth across from me.
"You seem happy to see me."
"I thought you were someone else." I took in the sight of him, chinos, dress shirt with a windbreaker over it. He laughed, thinking I was making a joke. Casually, I closed the atlas and laid it on the seat beside me, then leaned to the right as though scanning the entrance. "Reba's not with you?"
"Not at all. That's why I stopped in. I'm trying to track her down."
His eyes strayed to the atlas.
"Are you taking a trip?"
"Just indulging in fantasy. I've got too much work piled up to go anywhere."
"Oh, that's right. You're a private detective. What are you working on?"
I knew he couldn't care less about my caseload unless it involved him. I figured he was fishing, wondering if I was part of the government conspiracy to reel him in. I said, "The usual. A skip trace, a couple of employee background checks for the Bank of Santa Teresa, stuff like that." I droned on for a bit, making it up as I went along. I could see his eyes glaze over, and I hoped sincerely that I was boring him to death. I looked up in time to see Rosie appear through the swinging kitchen doors. Her eyes lighted on Beck like a terrier spotting a rat. She made a beeline for the booth, barely able to suppress her happiness. Beck collected himself and rose to his feet. He extended a hand to her, then leaned forward and bust her on the cheek.
"Rosie, you look beautiful. You've had your hair done."
"I did myself. It's home permanent," she said.
As far as I could see, her hair looked the way it always did. Badly dyed, badly cut. She dropped her gaze modestly.
"I remember what you want. Scotch. Double, with ice and water back. The 24th year, not the 12th.
"Very good. No wonder your customers are loyal."
I thought she'd see through the flattery, but she lapped it up, nearly dropping a little curtsy before she scurried off to get his drink. He sat down again, watching her departure with a fond smile as though he really gave a shit. His gaze drifted back to mine. He was a cold, cold man. The missing 25,000 had put him on red alert. He was out hunting to see who his enemies were. I crossed my arms and leaned forward, resting my elbows on the table. There was something restful about being in the company of someone I disliked so much. I didn't have to worry about impressing him, which allowed me to focus on the game at hand. How was Panama City?
Fine. Good. The problem started as soon as I came home. A little birdie tells me you and Reba got into trouble while I was gone.
Me? Well, dang, what did I do now?
You don't know what I'm referring to? We went shopping at the mall, if that counts for anything. The powwow with Marty. What was that about?
I blinked at him twice as though drawing a blank and then allowed the light to dawn. Friday night? We ran into him at the mall.
Once the stores closed down, we stopped in at Dale's and ordered a couple of bowls of that chili, guaranteed to give you the runs.
Jeez Louise, have you ever eaten that crap? Completely gross.
Enough already. Just get on with it.
Sorry.
So anyway, about that time, Marty came in. He was happy to see Reba. She introduced us and we chatted for a bit. End of story. He seemed to watch me from a distance, not yet satisfied.
What did you chat about?
Nothing in particular. I meet the guy, I'm nice, that's all it amounted to.
Why do you care?
You didn't talk about me?
You?
Not at all. Your name never came up.
Then what?
What do you mean, then what?
Where'd you go from there?
I shrugged. The office. Marty was bragging about the new digs and said he'd show us around, so we ended up doing a quick tour. He said you'd be pissed if you heard.
Is that what this is about?
I don't believe you've finished. Isn't there something else?
Well, let's see now. Oh, now this is earth-shattering. I left my purse on the roof, and we had to pop back the next day and go in search of it. What a pain in the ass that was.
Rosie approached with Beck's scotch on a tray. We dropped the topic of conversation and smiled at her blandly while she set down a ceremonial doily and put his drink on it. Beck murmured his thanks without engaging her in further conversation. She hesitated, hoping for another round of fawning and compliments, but he was intent on me. I was wishing she'd sit down and talk to us the rest of the night. Instead, she flicked me a look, suspicious that this was romance a-brewing. Little did she know, I was sitting there frantically assessing the situation, trying to guess how much Beck knew and how he'd acquired the information. If he'd seen security tapes, I had to make sure I accounted for all our comings and goings. I was aware my being a wise ass was getting on his nerves, but I couldn't help myself. Rosie manufactured a bit of small talk and then departed. I looked at Beck, waiting for his next move. He picked up his scotch and took a sip, watching me over the rim of his glass.
Clever. You explain it all so nicely, but somehow I'd swear you're lying through your pearly whites.
My reputation must precede me. I'm good at lying, I said.
He set his drink on the table, making a circular pattern with the moisture from the bottom of the glass.
So, where is she?
Reba?
Beats me. We are not joined at the hip.
Really? You've been with her constantly, and now suddenly you have no idea? She must have said something.
Beck, I think you've gotten the wrong impression. We're not friends. Her father paid me to go get her.
That's the kind of pal I am. I took her to the parole office and the DMV. She was lonesome. We had dinner.
Don't forget Bubbles.
Big deal. We went to Bubbles. I was feeling sorry for her. She doesn't have any friends except Annie, who treats her like a piece of shit.
He thought about that briefly and shifted gears.
What she told you about me?
I tried to make the big eyes like Reba did when she was feigning innocence.
About you?
Well, gosh now. She told me you screwed her brains out in the car the other night. She was going to give me all the nitty-gritty details about the size of your dick, but I begged off. No offense, but I don't find you nearly as fascinating as she does. Except for the current conversation. What are you fishing for?
Nothing. Maybe I misjudged you.
Well, I doubt that, but so what? Sounds like you're the one in trouble and projecting it on us.
I might have pushed the line too far because I wasn't that crazy about the look he turned on me.
Why do you say that?
Because you're laying out all this bullshit, and I don't have a clue what you want. You've peppered me with questions from the minute you sat down.
He was dead silent for about 15 seconds. A long time in the middle of a conversation of this type. Then he said, I believe she stole money from me when she was in the office that night. Ah, got it. That's a serious accusation. Yes, it is. Why not turn the matter over to the cops? I can't prove she did it. I shook my head. Doesn't sound right to me. I was with her when we toured the office, and she never touched a thing. Me neither, for that matter. I hope you don't think I'm involved, because I swear I'm not. It's not you I'm worried about, it's her.
You're worried?
I think she's in trouble. I'd hate to see her hurt.
Why didn't you just say so up front?
You're right, I'm sorry. I went about this all wrong, and I apologize. Truce?
We don't need a truce. I'm worried about her, too. She's back to smoking a pack a day, and God knows what else. This morning she was talking about booze and poker parlors. Scared the crap out of me.
I didn't realize you'd seen her.
Oh, sure. I thought I mentioned that.
You didn't, but that's good. I haven't heard a word from her since I got back. She's usually on the phone first thing, tugging at my sleeve. You know, Reeb, she tends to cling.
I'll say. Look, she talked about us having lunch tomorrow. Why don't I tell her to give you a call? He smiled, tentatively, wanting to believe me. At the same time, I could sense his scrutiny, testing my comments for any false notes. Happily, since I am a thoroughly accomplished liar, I could pass a polygraph disavowing murder with blood still dripping from my fingers. He reached out and tapped my hand, something I'd seen him do with her. I wondered what the gesture meant. A sort of tag, you're it?
I hope I wasn't out of line. You're a good egg, he said.
Thanks. You are too. I reached out and tapped his hand in return.
He pushed up from the booth. Better to let you go. I've taken up enough of your time as it is. Sorry if I was rude. I didn't mean to grill you.
Hey, I understand. Stay and have another drink if you like.
Nah, I gotta hit the road. Just tell Reba I'm looking for her.
What's your schedule tomorrow? Are you at the office all day?
You bet. I'll be waiting for her call.
Good luck, I thought. I watched him crossing the room, trying to see him as I had at first. I'd thought he was sexy and good-looking, but those qualities had vanished. Now I saw him for what he was, a guy accustomed to having his own way. The world centered on him, and others were simply there to service his whims. I wondered if he were capable of killing. Possible, I thought. Maybe not with his own hands, but he could have it done. Belatedly, a warm drop of sweat trickled down the middle of my back. I allowed myself a deep breath, and by the time Cheney showed up, I was feeling calm again and slightly bemused. He slid in next to me and pushed a folded slip of paper in my direction.
Don't say I never did you one. Address is a rental.
Misty's been in residence the past 13 months. Thanks. I glanced at the address and put the paper into my pocket. He said,
What's the smile about? You're looking pleased with yourself.
How long have I known you? A couple of years, right?
More or less. You haven't really known me until this past week.
Know what I realized? I've never lied to you.
I should hope not.
I'm serious. I'm a natural-born liar. But so far, I haven't lied to you. That puts you in a category all by yourself. Well, except for Henry. I can't remember ever lying to him about anything important.
Good news. I love the part where you say, so far. You're the only person I know who could say something like that and think it was a compliment.
Rosie appeared, and when she caught sight of Cheney, she shot me a quizzical look. She seldom saw me with one man, let alone two, on the same night. Cheney ordered a beer. Once she was gone, I rested my chin on my fist so I could look at him. His face was smooth, and there was the faintest web of lines at the outer corners of his eyes. Dark suede sport coat, the color of coffee grounds, beige shirt, brown silk tie hanging slightly askew. I reached out and straightened it. He caught my hand and kissed my index finger. I smiled. Have you ever dated an older woman?
Talking about yourself? I got news for you, kiddo. I'm older than you.
You are not.
I'm 39. April 1948.
He took out his wallet, flipped it open, removed his driver's license, and held it up.
Get serious. You were born in 1948?
How old did you think I was?
Somebody told me you were 34.
Lies, all lies. You can't believe a word you hear on the street.
He put his license in his wallet, which he flipped shut and returned to his hip pocket. In that case, your body's even better than I thought. Tell me the day and month again. I wasn't paying attention.
April 28. I'm a Taurus, like you. That's why we get along so well.
Is that true?
Sure. Look at us. We're Earth signs. The Bull. We're the Boy Scouts of the Zodiac. Determined, practical, reliable, fair-minded, stable. In other words, boring as hell. On the downside, we're jealous, possessive, opinionated, and self-righteous. So, what's not to like? We hate change, we hate interruptions, we hate being rushed.
You really believe all that stuff?
No, but you have to admit there's a certain ring of truth to it. Rosie returned to the table with Cheney's beer. I could tell she was tempted to loiter, hoping to catch a snippet of conversation. Both of us sank into silence until she left again. Then I said, Beck was here.
You're changing the subject. I'd rather talk about us.
Premature.
Then why don't we talk about you?
Absolutely not.
For instance, I like it that you don't wear makeup.
I've worn it twice. That first day at lunch and then again the other night.
I know. That's how I figured I could get you between the sheets.
Cheney, we need to talk about Reba. I leave for Reno first thing tomorrow morning. We have to be operating off the same page.
His expression sobered to some extent, and I could see him shift into business mode.
Okay, but don't be dragging it out. We have better things to do.
Business first.
Yes, ma'am.
We spent the next 10 minutes talking about Reba and Beck. What he'd said, what I'd said, and what, if anything, it meant. Cheney intended to call Priscilla Holloway in the morning and bring her up to speed. He thought the straightforward approach was preferable to taking the risk that she'd find out anyway. He'd refer her to Vince Turner and let the two of them work out their arrangements. If Holloway wanted Reba picked up, then all the better for him. Vince would be thrilled to have her under lock and key. Finally, Cheney said, "Can we go now? All this talk about criminals is turning me on."
Chapter 26.
The drive from Santa Teresa to Reno took 9 hours, including 2 potty stops and a 15-minute lunch break. The first 7 hours got me as far as Sacramento, where Highway 80 intersects the 5 and begins its slow climb toward the Donner Summit, 7,240 feet above sea level. Smoke from a series of brush fires in the Tahoe National Forest had saturated the air with a pale brown haze that followed me across the Nevada state line. I reached the Reno city limits at supper time and cruised through town just to get a feel for the place. Most of the buildings were 2 and 3 stories tall, dwarfed by the occasional chunky hotel. Aside from the casinos, businesses seemed to be devoted to making cash readily available. The working theme was cheap food and pawn shops, with the word guns writ large on 2 out of every 7 signs. I chose an unprepossessing 2-story motel in the heart of town, its prime attraction being that it sat on a lot adjacent to a McDonald's. I checked in, found my second-floor room, and put my duffel bag on the bed. Before I left again, I picked up the Reno phone book I found in my bed table drawer. I went downstairs, left the phone book in my car, and then proceeded to McDonald's, where I sat in a window seat and treated myself to a couple of QPs with cheese. According to the strip maps I'd picked up at the auto club, Carson City, the last known domicile of the erstwhile Robert Dietz, was only 30 miles away.
Because of Cheney, I thought about Dietz without bitterness, but without much interest. While I munched fries doused in ketchup, I opened the Reno City map and looked for the street where Misty Rain was supposedly living these days. Wasn't far away, and I thought my next order of business was to pay a visit to the place. I dumped my trash and returned to my car. With the map propped against the steering wheel, I sketched out my course. The route took me through Spartan neighborhoods of pines, chain-link fences, and ranch houses faced in stucco or brick. Even at 7 in the evening, the light was good. The air was hot and dry and smelled of pine pitch and charred oak from the California fires. I knew the temperatures would drop as soon as the sun went down. The lawns I passed were parched, the grasses scorched to a soft yellow-brown. The trees, on the other hand, were surprisingly green, dense, healthy foliage a relief in the relentless, washed-out beige of the surrounding landscape. Maybe the whole of it was designed to keep all the gamblers indoors, where gaudy colors dazzled the eye, the air temperature was constant, and lights were ablaze 24 hours a day. I spotted the house I was looking for, a one-story yellow wood-frame bungalow with three stingy windows across the front. The trim was brown, and the door to the single-car garage was decorated with three vertical rows of triangles, yellow paint on brown. Shaggy evergreens marked the corners of the house, and the flower beds along the drive were filled with desiccated plant stalks. I parked on the far side of the street about four houses down with a clear view of the drive. When sitting surveillance, there's always a concern that a neighbor will call the cops to complain about a suspicious vehicle parked out front. To create a diversion, I removed two orange plastic construction cones from the well of my car and then went around to the rear where I opened the engine compartment. I set up the cones nearby, signaling engine trouble in case anyone got curious. I stood near the car and scanned the surrounding houses. I saw no one. I crossed the street to Misty's front door and rang the bell. 3 minutes passed, and then I knocked. No response. I leaned my head against the door. Silence. I walked down the drive and scrutinized the padlocked garage, which was connected to the house by a short, enclosed breezeway. Both garage windows were locked, and the glass had been painted over. I headed around the front of the house. A wooden fence on the far side opened into a backyard that was depressingly bare. No sign of pets, no children's toys, no lawn furniture, and no barbecue. The windows that overlooked the patio were dark. I cupped my hands to the glass and found myself staring at a home office equipped with the usual desk and swivel chair, a computer, phone, and copier. No sign of Misty or Reba. I was disappointed, having persuaded myself that Reba was staying with her. Now what? I returned to the car and settled in to wait, amusing myself by browsing the yellow pages of the borrowed phone book. Bored with that, I picked up the first one of three paperbacks I'd brought for this purpose. It was comforting that most of the nearby houses remained dark, suggestive of occupants at work. At 8:10, I saw a Ford Fairlane slow on approach and ease into Misty's drive. In the fading daylight, primer paint on the driver's side of the car glowed as though luminescent. A woman emerged, wearing a white halter, tight jeans, and high heels without hose. She reached into the back seat for two cumbersome plastic grocery bags, crossed to the front door, and let herself in. I could see interior lights go on as she moved through the house. This had to be the very Misty Rain that I was looking for. So far, no one had questioned my presence on the block. I got out, retrieved the orange plastic cones, and returned them to my car. This by way of being prepared for whatever might come next. I resumed my reading with the help of a penlight I dug out of my bag. At intervals, I glanced up. But the house remained quiet and nobody entered or left. At 9:40, prison-strength exterior spots came on, flooding the driveway with harsh white light. Misty emerged from the house, leaving lights on behind her as she got in her tank-sized Ford and backed out of the drive. I waited 15 seconds, fired up my VW, and followed. Once we reached the first intersection, there was sufficient traffic to provide cover, though I didn't think she had any reason to suspect she was being tailed. She drove sedately, refraining from any abrupt or tricky moves that would indicate a concern about the 13-year-old pale blue VW traveling 3 car lengths behind. We proceeded into town. She took a right on East 4th, and after a half a block turned into a small city parking lot that sat between an Asian restaurant and a mini-market with a marquee that read, "Groceries, Beer, Slots." I slowed and pulled over to the curb. I left the engine running while I spread out my Reno map and studied the layout. I don't know why I went to such trouble to disguise my purposes. Misty didn't seem to be aware of me, and certainly no one else in Reno cared if I was lost. I watched her enter the mini-market and took advantage of her absence to pull into the same lot. I parked as close to the entrance as I could manage. Each space was numbered in paint, and a board posted on the brick wall of the market indicated that fees were paid on the honor system. Dutifully, I searched out the requisite window and inserted the number of dollar bills I thought would cover my stay. I was so engrossed in this display of municipal virtue that I didn't spot Misty until she was halfway across the street, munching a candy bar. She had a carton of cigarettes under one arm. Her destination lay dead ahead, an adult entertainment establishment called the Flesh Emporium. Under the double row of light bulbs spelling out the name of the place, a blinking neon sign flashed, "Girls, girls, girls, nude, lewd, and crude." And in smaller letters, "Tattoos and piercing done while you wait." And smaller still, "Books, videos, live reviews." The bouncer waved her in. I waited a decent interval and then crossed the street. There was a $20 cover charge that had grieved me to pay, but I ponied up the cash. I made a note to myself to add it to my expense account in a manner that didn't suggest play-for-pay sex. Inside the entrance, a modest-sized casino was hazy with cigarette smoke, the air aglow with the ambient light from 100 slot machines lined up back-to-back. In passing, I picked up the soft, goofy flute and bell music that accompanies play. The acoustical tile ceiling was low, dotted with can lights, cameras, smoke alarms, and sprinkler heads. Scarcely anyone was seated at the slots, but farther in, beyond the blackjack tables, I could see a darkened bar with a wide apron built along one side. On 3 hotly lighted platforms, nude dancers undulated, strutted, and otherwise exhibited body parts. Nothing they did seemed particularly lewd or crude. I found a table toward the rear, feeling ill at ease. Most of the customers were men. All were drinking, and most paid little attention to the breasts and buttocks on parade in front of them. There was no sign of Misty, but a waitress named Joy arrived at my table and placed a cocktail napkin in front of me. Sequined pasties, the size of dinner mints, chastely shielded her nipples from public scrutiny, and she wore a glittering fig leaf over what my Aunt Jin would call her privates. I ordered a bottle of Bass Ale, theorizing there was no way the management could water it down. When Joy returned with my beer and a basket of tinted yellow popcorn, I paid the $15 tab and tipped her an extra $5. "I'm looking for Misty. Is she here?"
"She just went to change. She'll be out in a bit. You're a friend of hers?"
"Not quite, but close enough," I said.
"Give me your name and I'll tell her you're here."
"She won't know my name. A friend of a friend said I should look her up if I was ever passing through."
"What's the friend's name?"
"Reba Lafferty."
"Lafferty. I'll tell her."
I sipped my beer and picked at the cold, chewy popcorn, glad for the distraction, as I didn't really favor watching nude women shaking their booties at me even from a distance. I'd imagined voluptuous, showgirl-style bodies, but only one of the three had the requisite football-size knockers. I figured the other two were saving up.
As it turned out, Misty hadn't gone to change her clothes so much as to strip off the garment she was wearing when she got to work. Her legs were bare, and only a thong and her high heels remained. She was tall and lanky, with pitch-black hair, a prominent collarbone, and long, thin arms. By way of contrast, she had breasts of burdensome dimensions, the kind that give you back problems and require a bra with straps so fierce they create permanent tracks across your shoulder blades like ruts worn in rock. Not that I've ever suffered from such a fate, but I've heard women complain. I couldn't imagine choosing to haul those things around. Her eyes were large and green with dark circles underneath that even heavy makeup couldn't hide. I placed her in her 40s, though I wasn't sure quite where. Joy says you're a friend of Reba's. I didn't know stripper greeting etiquette, but I stood and shook her hand. Kinsey Milhone, I'm from Santa Teresa. Same as Reba, she remarked. How's she doing these days? I was hoping you'd tell me. Can't help you there. I haven't seen her in years. Are you in town on vacation, or what's the deal? I'm here looking for her. One of Misty's shoulders went up in what passed for a shrug. Last I heard, she's in prison. California Institute for Women. Not anymore. She was released on the 20th of this month. No fooling. Well, good for her. I'll have to drop her a line. The real world's a shock when you're not used to it, she said. Hope she makes it. The prospects of that are dim. She did well at first, but lately things haven't been so hot. Sorry to hear that, but why come to me? Just a long shot, I said. Must have been awful long. I've worked here a week. I don't get how you managed to track me down. Process of elimination. Reba told me you worked as an exotic dancer. With a name like yours, it wasn't difficult. Get off it. You know how many strip joints there are in this town? 35. This is the 13th I've tried. Must be my lucky number. Can we chat? About what? I start work in 2 minutes. I need time to get centered. Gig like this is tough unless you have your head on straight. I won't keep you long. Gingerly, she perched, and I wondered if the wooden chair seat felt cold on her bare butt. The sensation couldn't be that keen, but she didn't yelp or otherwise vocalize dismay. She said, "Is this a fishing expedition, or did you want something in particular?" "Why do you ask?" "I just thought if I heard from her, I could pass the message along, provided it's not obscene. I've heard she's in town. I'm hoping to talk her into coming back to California before she blows the terms of her parole. It's no skin off my nose what she blows, or who, for that matter. I understand you were cellmates. 6 months or so. I got out before she did, obviously. She told me you kept in touch. Why not? She's a nice kid, and she's fun to be around. When was the last time you heard from her? Mock thought. Must have been last Christmas. I sent her a card, and she sent one back. She glanced over her shoulder. Sorry to cut this short, but that music is my cue. If she happens to get in touch, tell her I'm in Reno. We really need to talk. I'd written the name of the motel, the telephone number, and my room number on a slip of paper that I handed her as she stood. She took the note, though she had no place to put it unless she stuck it up her bum. So who's paying you? Her dad. Nice job. Like a bounty hunter, huh? It's more than a job. I'm a friend, and I'm concerned about her welfare. I wouldn't lose any sleep over it. One thing about Reba, she can take care of herself. I watched her head for the bar. The matching moons of her ass scarcely wobbled as she walked, and I could see the muscles in her thighs flex and relax with every step she took. Bumping and grinding must be better than jazzercise, plus she didn't have to pay the weekly freight. I made a stop in the ladies' room where I availed myself of the facilities before returning to my car. Once there, I fired up the engine and sat with the windows rolled down, listening to the radio to pass the time. An hour later, I began to worry about, one, running out of gas, or two, asphyxiating myself with my own exhaust fumes. I cut the radio, killed the engine, and stared at the brick wall in front of me.
This was the perfect screen on which to project recent memories of